Stuart, welcome to Cambridge 105 again and the election studio. In 2015, I think that Cambridge was described as something like the Greens' third most winnable seat. But I had a look. I can't find it on the list this time. What's happened?
I'm not sure if it was ever that high on our list. It's certainly an area where we've got huge potential. We've got the potential to grow and win the seat in coming years. But I'm not sure exactly where it falls on the list this time around. I think there are certainly very winnable seats for the Greens around the country in places like Bristol and Bath, the Isle of Wight, for example. Cambridge is a tough area for us in the terms of voting intention and in terms of the split amongst the parties. But in terms of the demographics and the people that live here and the support we know that we have in the communities, it's certainly a very good city for us.
I was interested by your opening comments there. So you see this as much about building the influence for the Greens. Obviously, you're hoping to win, but the implication from your answer was that, well, coming a good second would be pretty good as well.
I think I'm as good, if not better, a candidate than the other candidates that are standing here. I think we've got the best policies. Only the Green Party have a real transformational vision of how to answer the challenges that face the country. So, I want us to win. I want us to win seats because I think getting Green representatives in Parliament is better than what the other parties can offer. But I have to be realistic. We don't have the resources of the other parties. It's very difficult for us to get around the city and knock on as many doors as Labour and the Liberal Democrats and put as much through people's doors as them. So I have to be realistic and think about building.
And that's a matter of members, resources, combination of both?
Resources. We don't get anywhere near as much money in from donations from big business or from trade unions. So it's difficult for us. And we hold ourselves to very high standards. All our leaflets are fully recycled and on vegetable links, for example, as well. So, yeah, we can't put as much through people's doors as the other parties can. And there has been a big growth in the Labour Party membership locally, for example, in recent years. So it is difficult for us to knock on as many doors. But having said that, I want us to get into a position where we can win Cambridge. But you have to be realistic about that. That does take time. But you need people to break out of this idea that they need to vote tactically and vote for the policies and the people they best believe in.
Do Cambridge people care about the environment, do you think?
Definitely, yes.
Enough to make a voting decision?
I think you can see from the records of the other candidates in Cambridge that the environment is very important to people, and they force that up, and they really insist that their elected representatives represent them in that regard. There are a huge amount of environmental charities, sustainability organisations here, community groups, a lot of people doing allotments and improving and protecting biodiversity locally. So there really is a big green feeling in Cambridge. And you can see that they've forced that upon their candidates because both Julian Huppert and Daniel Zeichner have been good for the environment in certain ways. So I think there's a big green feeling in the city, and people don't always necessarily feel like they need to vote green to get that. But there definitely is, very good support for the environment in Cambridge.
And membership of the Green Party within the city of Cambridge, because go back to the list of these winnable seats, I did notice that there were a couple of Cambridgeshire constituencies, which were a little bit lower down the list, but nonetheless areas where the Greens think, yeah, we might do okay.
What's the question?
So the membership of the Green Party within the city of Cambridge, is that
I think
up,
we have
down?
300, 350 members or so, slightly down from when we had a big surge before the 2015 election. There's a big turnover in people in Cambridge that everyone knows, so a lot of people coming and going, and quite often I ring up new members and find that they've already moved to somewhere else.
That's the problem, isn't it? The transient nature of some
persons
in Cambridge.
But we're building a very good core of really interested activists, really good candidates, people who are interested in the local areas. And building up and trying to make sure that we put ourselves in a position to win elections here in the coming years.
So Brexit then, which is an area clearly of concern, particularly in Cambridge. You'll be familiar, of course with the number of people who voted to stay against the country trend. How do we influence that through a vote for the Greens? And what's your direct policy on that?
So we have as opposed to the Liberal Democrats' policy, which was, I've heard Julian Huppert saying at Hustings, for example, we shouldn't have had that referendum in 2016, we shouldn't have given people their say, but we should have a referendum now. We take a very different approach in that we do believe in democracy. We were in favour of having the referendum before. We think that people were entitled to their say, but we don't think that should be the end of the democratic process. There should be another vote and an opportunity for people to influence the process as it goes forward. That takes the form of a vote over.
So the process rather than another in or out, because there is this YouGov poll, I think, which suggested, I'm trying to remember the numbers off the top of my head now, something like 68, 69% of people are actually happy, or say they're happy. They don't necessarily agree with the result, but they're happy happy as you can be, to at least accept the result.
Yeah, and we accept the result. We accept that we should start negotiating with the European Union and opening these negotiations about leaving the European Union. That doesn't mean that the government should have a free rein to negotiate whatever it wants in the interests of, you know, whatever party happens to win this next election. People should be entitled to have their say over what options come next, because there was a huge amount of that wasn't told to people at the 2016 referendum. The options weren't necessarily made clear, whether we stay in the single market, whether we retain free movement, whether we retain a lot of the jurisdiction of the European courts, for example. So when we have a clear definition of what exactly Brexit looks like, I still do feel, and that is our policy, that people should have an opportunity to vote on that deal.
On the subject of voting, in Brighton, I know there was a pact between the Lib Dems and the Greens. I know there's a number of Brighton constituencies, but in particular I'm thinking of the Caroline Lucases, one of your co-leaders, to be precise on that, and the Lib Dem candidate stepping down. Did you ever get so far as to think about calling Dr. Huppert and saying, I'll step down to make sure you get over the line with your anti-Brexit view?
No. around the country, it's the Green.
Not even cross your mind? Has it thought of for the good of the country?
I've had pressure from people within both the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats in stepping down in favour of their candidates. And I've been very clear that at the last election, over 4,000 people in this city still chose to vote Green despite this huge amount of insistence that they had to vote tactically. It had to be Labour or Lib Dem. So there's a huge proportion of there's a huge proportion of people in Cambridge that want a Green representative, and they deserve to be represented. Across the country, it's very right and grown up of the Green Party that we've talked about making alliances, because I understand it's very, very important that we beat the Conservatives at this election. And the Greens are the most serious about that. If the Labour Party were as serious, they would have stood down candidates in the Isle of Wight to give us a decent chance of beating the Tory candidate there. In the city of Cambridge, I can't endorse either Labour or the Liberal Democrats because I don't agree with what the Liberal Democrats did in government, very much not. And I don't think the Labour Party...
They were in coalition. They weren't in number 10.
Decisions on the bedroom tax, on what happened to the NHS, on tuition fees, are things that I won't forget lightly. And I don't think the people of this country should either. And I don't agree with Labour's policy on Brexit, though their latest manifesto is better than the ones went previously. So my message is very clear. If you want someone who's pro-European, who's pro-public services and anti-austerity, then Green Party is the only option in Cambridge.
And the people who spoke to you from the Labour Party and the Lib Dems in Cambridge, what level were they? We're talking just a councillor, chairman?
When I say pressure from people, it's just activists, people I know within either parties, you know, and there was never anything official. As I've said, I don't think we need to endorse either party in Cambridge. And it's right, the Conservatives don't really stand much of a chance in Cambridge City, so people have the right to have a good choice over who their representative is that goes to Parliament.
Now, you've worked in social care and now with the NHS, of course, at Addenbrookes. How long have you been there now?
3 years at Addenbrookes, just about.
And you're a charge nurse?
Rapid response team.
Right, so how does that, what sort of responsibility do you have?
The rapid response team at Addenbrookes, we cover the entire hospital. It's a number of specialist nurses. We work with a registrar and a consultant, medical staff as well. We respond to patients that are deteriorating on the wards, so getting worse, deteriorating, when the nurses or the staff on those wards need extra support, and whether that person needs to be assessed as needing to go to intensive care or high dependency units. And we manage their admission to intensive care or high dependency. And we also respond to all the cardiac arrest situations in the hospital.
And have you seen the time? How long have you been there now? You've been there four years?
Addenbrookes in total.
Yes.
Three years.
And I wonder if you've seen any changes in terms of, I guess, the resources given to Addenbrookes. Different management can obviously take a different view. But in terms of what's coming in and what's available in terms of resources, do you see a change over that time?
It's been very up and down at times because shortly after I arrived, there was the introduction of the Epic computer system. There was all the hassle around the CQC inspections, which said that Addenbrookes wasn't an acceptable standard. And there was a huge drive to make improvements after that, which was right. Having said that, the pressure on the hospital is definitely increasing, whereas we used to experience a winter crisis. We're just experiencing an all-year-round crisis now. Even in May, June, there's still a huge pressure on beds. There's not enough capacity. I have to make very difficult decisions about whether to admit people to intensive care or high dependency when there's a lack of beds.
And this is a result of, I guess, within the NHS, potentially, people not looking after themselves or resources taken from elsewhere?
There's a number of issues. One of the main issues is the lack of funding going to social care and public health and preventative health. There's definitely an increase in people coming to A&E and coming to hospital. And it's very, very difficult for Adamooks to discharge people into the community because of a lack of resources in the community as well, which creates a bottleneck in the hospital where, you know, we're just filled up and the people aren't leaving at the rate that we need them to. But there's also a huge issue around what happens with the staff working in Addenbrookes. Staff, a lot of them can't afford to live here. A lot leave because of the pressure on them and the difficult
conditions. I was going to ask you that. And I was just wondering how many of your immediate colleagues, you know, those people who you chat to when you're on a well-deserved break, is there how many actually live in Cambridge?
Very few. Very few that I know. Most live in Haverhill or Newmarket or areas around where they can travel into Cambridge because
that's quite a distance, really. Yeah. It's not like living in an outlying village or something, 3 or 4 miles out of the city.
Yeah, a lot of people travel a lot of distance, and you know, driving into your shifts in the morning, driving home late at night after having worked 13 hours is dangerous, and it's not good for the environment to have so many people traveling around from great distances either. And I just would say as well that since I started on the ward where I started working on 3 years ago when I first came to Cambridge, there's not a single nurse at the level I started at still working on that ward in the same role, which gives you an idea of the huge amount of turnover, whether that's to do with people leaving, the number of migrants we have who come to work in services and then leave to go back or go to work in other hospitals. So it's quite incredible, a ward where the entire staff has turned over within 3 years pretty much.
I'm at the risk of going off at a tangent, I'm interested at the migrant issue here. So people there coming over as mm-hmm. And then they return from back whence they came?
Yeah,
and
I think particularly with EU migrants, quite a few come for experience for a year or two and then perhaps go. I think migrants from overseas, the evidence, I don't know the exact figures, they would tend to stay for probably longer because they've travelled further and you build lives here with a bit more solid foundations. Mm. But also, a lot of people who come here from overseas are put into jobs, the first job they could get, which they didn't necessarily want as much. They get 6 months to a year's experience there, they move on to something else.
So I wonder if there's resources within training, for example, it could potentially be an issue.
Yeah, there is definitely. There's less resources now for nurse training and for retaining staff, because it's not just about recruiting people. We need to make sure we can keep them when they get here as well, keep them happy in jobs. And the cost of living is a huge factor in that. If people can't afford to live in good housing close to the hospital where they work, then of course they're going to look at other options, look at moving abroad or moving to other places to work.
And returning to the issue of the NHS and social care, the issues which are clearly there, how do we fix them?
Well, we need to make brave decisions. One thing I would say about the Tory manifesto recently is they did acknowledge the need to make honest decisions about funding social care. What I very much disagree with is the idea of forcing that cost onto individuals who are unfortunate enough to suffer from Alzheimer's or dementia, people who do need care in the longer run. The new dementia tax plan by the Tory government, which has been in absolute disarray over the last week, is disgusting. It's an absolute lottery in terms of who needs care. Some of us are fortunate enough to get to very late in lives without needing care. Some of us might need care from a very young age. It's only right that as a society, we pool our resources, we pay taxes progressively amongst the population, and we fund a system that guarantees everyone will get a right to good, decent, dignified care without having to give up their home to pay for it. Mm-hmm.
How does the proposed 4-day-a-week, which the Greens have put forward in the manifesto, work in somewhere like the NHS? Because by the sounds of things, you'd need more staff straight away.
Well, the NHS, a great number of the staff don't work a set Monday to Friday pattern anyway. Nurses, for example, a lot work only 3 days a week, but very long shifts. The idea of the 4-day working week is that studies have shown people are more productive when they spend shorter amounts of time at work and have more breaks. Staff in the UK are definitely amongst the most overworked, with the fewest breaks and fewest public holidays of almost any workforces in Europe. If we can get people working less hours but working more productively and performing the same amount of work, then that's a great benefit to the country. And you'll see, for example, the effects of overwork on the NHS staffing population and the huge amounts of people that have to go off with stress, with anxiety, with mental health issues. We'll save a lot of those costs by being able to reduce the amount of hours that people work.
If I was running a small business, but if I was running a small business and I was employing 12, 13 people, and I was told that they all had to go on 4-day-a-weeks, so I would think, you know, oh no, now what have I got to look after?
Well, as I've said, I think if you were to look at the amount of productivity, the amount that you get for the work, the hours that the people are putting in, actually ensuring that they've got a well-balanced work-life ratio, that they've got time to rest, would ensure that those 4 days when they're in working, they're producing more for you, producing more for your business.
Another eye-catching policy from the Greens is this idea of a basic income, which I know the Scandinavians have been. I think even in Finland there was even
a piloting, yes.
a pilot of 2,000 people, I think it might have been. How would that work in the British environment?
So it's a very interesting idea, and we're clear it's not something we're saying we could introduce overnight. It's not something we would replace the entire welfare system with overnight, for example. But a universal basic income is the idea that as work changes in coming decades, coming generations, there's going to be increasing amounts of automation, of robots doing jobs, for example. We need to make sure that that doesn't increase unemployment and mean more and more people laid off without a basic income to get by on. A universal basic income would mean almost a kind of citizen's salary paid to every member of the population to cover their basic costs. It isn't a case of taking a huge more amount of money, investing it, because it would replace a lot of the existing welfare system that already is there. It would enable us to decrease poverty. It would enable people to take breaks from work and explore other options for changing career, for example. But as I've said, it's not been fully rolled out in a country yet. It's something we would like to explore. We would possibly introduce a pilot, as is happening in Finland and in some states of America and Canada, I understand, as well.
So I suppose there'd be a saving, for example, something like, as another topic elsewhere in the election campaign, of course, the winter fuel allowance for the elderly. If you were to have this in, you'd save your costs on having to do any means testing, because everybody would be getting this basic level?
Yeah, you would. It would make the system a lot simpler in terms of the benefits that are paid out. It could replace a number of the existing things that are there already. For example, it could replace a lot of the tax credits that the government pays, which essentially are a subsidy to employers to pay low wages. A basic income would ensure that everyone has a decent income, which is enough for them to get by on. And there are huge costs associated with poverty and destitution in this country. Ensuring that everyone has their basic needs met will save the country in the longer term.
But I wonder, at some point, somebody has to pay higher taxes to fund it all. It's not all going to come from savings, from mean testing, or topping up benefits which are there anyway. This
yes.
must mean not just a few pence, several pence on the higher rate taxpayer.
Well, what's happening in the UK at the moment is we do have a collapsing tax base, effectively, because of the rise of the gig economy, the rise of self-employed people, the ability of multinational corporations to avoid tax. We do have much more difficulty in bringing enough taxes to sustain our public services. But that's not to say we're as wealthy. We're not as wealthy as we were before. There is enough wealth there to fund decent public services in one of the richest countries in the world. We would look, number one, it's a question of priorities as well. We would cancel some of the existing very high value vanity schemes of the government, such as Trident and High Speed Rail, which could save a huge amount of money, which could fund things like abolishing tuition fees, for example. But there are a number of innovative ways that we would like to see introduced of bringing in tax, not necessarily on the incomes of the lowest, but on wealth and on financial transactions and on property, for example. It's currently in the UK, the poorest 10% of people pay more of their incomes in tax than the richest 10%. Because of regressive taxation like VAT or council tax or national insurance. A number of ways we could do that, for example, include a financial transactions tax, which is already being explored by 11 other member states of the European Union, which is essentially an extension of existing stamp duty on financial transactions, okay. which could bring in £20 billion a year. Abolishing the internal market in the NHS, for example, could also save between £4 and £10 billion a year. And one of our innovative ideas as well is a wealth tax on the richest 1% of the population, an annual levy of 2% of their overall wealth, again, which is already done in other European countries such as France and the Netherlands, which could bring in a huge amount of money for public services as well. And it's right at a time like this, when we're making difficult decisions about where to spend money, that we say those that can afford it should be able to pay more so that we can sustain decent public services in what is a very rich country.
What's your most important policy for Cambridge?
The main issues facing Cambridge, well, I would say the number one would be the cost of housing, the difficulty people have in affording to live here. So our policy of ending the right to buy so that government can keep hold of council and social housing for future generations would be very important. Our policy of building 100,000 new social affordable homes a year by 2022, and by reforming the housing market and changing the tax system around buy-to-let so that it's not so much the housing market isn't so much geared towards people speculating and investing in property, would really reduce the pressure on the housing market and make it much easier for people to afford to live in Cambridge from now on.
And it's interesting, I guess the people who put together the Green Manifesto, which maybe yourself and your colleagues contribute into, it must be challenging sometimes to maintain the green thread through everything at the same time, or do you feel it's a relatively easy thing to do, to be good to the environment and where we live in, whilst actually having policies that are sustainable themselves?
Yeah, well, you bring me on to the biggest issue facing us, which is dealt with very comprehensively in our manifesto, which is climate change. Because in the next 4 years, unless we make serious decisions to change course on the amount of carbon we burn, we will lose the chance of keeping global warming to a manageable level within 4 years. So the decisions that were made by the next members of parliament are hugely vital in this area. And it's shockingly negligent of the Conservative Party to, for example, allow fracking and continue subsidies for fossil fuel industries, which risks all of our future, because you can't have a strong and stable economy on a planet that's completely ruined. As you've said, the great thing and the thing that makes me really excited about green politics is that the projects that we push to save the environment are things that are also very, very good for people. One of our flagship policies is a nationwide home insulation and retrofitting program, which could insulate 9 million homes around the country, reducing people's fuel bills.
Making sure that the right amount of centimetres of stuff are in everybody's
lot. It would have to be done properly.
Yes.
But that could reduce people's fuel bills. It could end fuel poverty at the same time as making a huge contribution towards preventing climate change. Getting people out of their cars and onto bikes and walking and public transport will benefit the environment, but also benefit our health through reducing air pollution. There's many, many things that we can do that benefit both people and the planet, and it's very negligent of our government not to push ahead with those immediately.
Yeah, well, we'll see what the future government attends to with all of that. We'll have to judge. And I nearly said in 5 years' time. Who knows with the variable fixed Parliament Act?
I know, it seems like the only growth industry is leaflet printing at the moment, I would imagine, with the amount of elections and referendums we're holding.
Oh, yes. Stuart, the best of luck
from
us in the forthcoming election. Stuart Tuckwood, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.